This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodl Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Okay, I'm here at the National Astronomy Meeting in beautiful Llandudno, Wales. And I'm here with Professor Ewan Williams from Queen Mary University in London. And Professor Williams is an expert in comets and asteroids. And perhaps I could start by asking you, what is a comet and what is an asteroid?
I think traditionally it's certainly one of the view that comets are very distinguishable because you can see a tail from them. Asteroids did not show any tail or any formation like that. And from that you can extend your thought in saying tails form through ices melting and subliming as the comet approaches the sun. And then this throws out gas, carries out the dust, and you get the very spectacular tails on comets. Asteroids appear not to show any such activity, are nearer the sun, they're mostly all inside Jupiter, and so were thought to have formed there out of basically non-icy material, rocks and ice. So one is inside what people these days talk about, the snow line. Asteroid would form inside the snow line, comets would form outside, and perturbations have brought the comets in, so we can see some of them in the inner solar system now.
Okay, perhaps I can just ask you then, just to clarify what the snow line is.
I think the snow line is a word which has now come in as we start worrying about habitable zones around other planetary systems. The snow line is thought to indicate the line where ice could form, so you need to be far away out of the snow, or ice can exist in solid form, and inside that it doesn't exist in solid form, and is therefore much harder to find. It's very hard to trap gas, it's easy to trap solids.
Okay, so we have a rather neat picture that once we get beyond a certain distance from the sun, it's cold, and we have these snowballs, and these are comets, and inside that we have rocky objects, and these are asteroids. But I think, as you described in your talk here at the meeting today, it mightn't be as simple as all that.
No, obviously comets always come in. We see comets close to the Earth. But again, until recently, certainly the thought was very simply that even though they formed outside, perturbations from anything really, in the end, Jupiter brings a lot of them in so that they now pass close to the Earth and we can see the spectacular tail. Most of them still live, and we still believe that this is the case, most comets still live in the outer reaches of the solar system for most of their lives, either in the Kuiper Belt or in the so-called Oort Cloud, which is even further out. They occasionally come in. So yeah, that's basically the picture, but they've always done that. But those comets that come into the solar system until recently certainly were all thought, well, were all on elongated orbits, so you could see they originated out there somewhere, but they've just been pulled in, and for a very short part of their lives they're inside the so-called snow line when we see them with these spectacular tails, etc. What's changed is that over the last few years we've certainly discovered, by we I mean the astronomical community at large, have discovered four comets that are at present on near-circular orbits. And not only are they on near-circular orbits, they're on near-circular orbits essentially inside the asteroid belt. So they're circulating the Sun just like the asteroids between Mars and Jupiter.
Okay, so there are now comets masquerading as asteroids in the asteroid belt. So it begs the question of how can you tell the difference?
Just slightly correct you there in the sense that these four comets are not masquerading as asteroids. They appear like comets, they do form tails. So they are behaving like comets, they're not masquerading, they're being in the wrong place. They shouldn't be there, but they are there. There are also, indeed, one suspects, comets masquerading as asteroids. Comets can't eject material forever, and if they're losing all the ices, then slowly they stop becoming a snowball. And one may well argue, that one generally does argue, that what's going to happen is that the larger dust particles get left behind, and slowly you will become a dormant or a dead comet, and that may well look like an asteroid. But these four comets are not those. These are still active comets going on circular orbits.
Okay. So you mentioned that a comet can stop ejecting, and then when it's a dead comet, we might be fooled into thinking it's an asteroid. But a few months ago, there was a famous story of an asteroid that seemed to have a tail, a comet-like tail, but in fact is an asteroid. So perhaps you can explain that.
This is a very exciting discovery that at first we simply thought we'd discovered a fifth main belt comet, because to all extent and purposes it looked very similar to those. It was found first by having a long tail. As you discover a comet, this object was found having a very long, very clear tail. And indeed it was thought we have now found a fifth comet. People then started saying it doesn't quite look like an other cometary tails. There's very almost no evidence of gas. This was really just a dust tail with no evidence of gas. And nice pictures were obtained using the Hubble telescope, which then showed the parent object just outside the tail with also a very interesting shape and morphology to the tail. But the object was there. This object is clearly an asteroid. We just have a dust tail. The tail is not driven by gas being ejected from the parent. So it must be ejected by some other mechanism. And the only obvious mechanism must be a collision. If you have collision, of course, again, you throw off lots of dust as a result of the collision. But the fact we can see it now, we can see the tail, not only we see the tail now, we see the tail very, very close to the parent's body now. Such the collision must be very, very recent. And in reality, we are looking at the evidence of a collision within the last 5 years between some object and an asteroid.
Okay, so these have collided in the last 5 years. I sometimes have a picture of a solar system that formed a long time ago, billions of years ago, and is now somewhat calm and settled, and there's less collisions. It's still quite violent and still some collisions going on.
I think, yeah, that has been a developing theme over the last few years, that, as you say, if you go back 50 years and never saw the solar system is quiescent, it's not doing anything interesting at all, everybody's going round and round in circles. One identified chaos as being an important part of the solar system, and the more we look at things, the more we realise that it is far from being a quiet, dead place. Orbits are moving, collisions are taking place. As soon as you start changing orbits, collisions will inevitably result somehow, because you have elongated orbits crossing circular orbits and everything else, and orbits change their locality. Various forms of chaos have been identified, and also the resonances play a big part in the evolution of the solar system, and we're finding lots of evidence of that all over the place, not just in the asteroid comet connection. We had another paper almost following mine this morning where the same thing appeared to be taking place almost in the moons of Saturn, where there was evidence there.
So Saturn itself seems to be acting like a miniature solar system in its vicinity.
Yes, I think that's certainly the case, and in particular that there are also evidence of collisions and new dust, but both being seen circulating and also settling on some of the small satellites.
So you mentioned that in recent times our views have changed, and you mentioned that the Hubble Space Telescope was able to help you solve this mystery of the comet-like asteroid. And we all know how powerful the Hubble Space Telescope has been for distant objects, for cosmology. But you're studying objects in our backyard, so it must be very powerful. In fact, you can actually go to these objects and take samples. And is it correct that you have pieces of these in labs?
It's certainly true. All space missions, almost all space missions, wherever they go to, need to go through the asteroid belts to start with. And therefore, inevitably, with a little planning, you can get close flyby of several asteroids. And Rosetta went past Lutetia a few months ago by now, which is the largest asteroid by far so far that we've gone past. And interesting, we heard this morning again evidence that there was some outgassing, or some, not quite outgassing, some material sort of kept around Lutetia, so the density there was slightly higher than around the background. We've also had flybys of comets, not quite as numerous, obviously, as of asteroids. And as you say, there's been one return of samples, which is all much more accessible than galaxies and so on and so forth, you know.
Indeed, very much more accessible when you can actually hold it.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that space missions will have to go through the asteroid belt. That begs the question of, is that dangerous? Are we going to get struck by these objects?
What's emerging, obviously, as soon as the solar system stops being this nice, quiet place and collisions take place, we find that objects are on elongated orbits, we now know there's a very large population of certainly several hundred, if not several thousand, bodies whose orbits bring them within 1.3 astronomical units of the Earth, which are called near-Earth asteroids or near-Earth objects. And those all potentially can hit the Earth. Now, just to put everybody's mind at rest, none of them at present are thought to be on a collision course. But we have, over the last several years, built lots of new telescopes, or new detectors on telescopes at least, that are capable of trying to find all asteroids. And I think we've now been successful that more or less all asteroids down to 1 kilometre in size are essentially known. However, those less than 1 kilometre, there's still a large unknown population. And whereas they may not be large enough to cause global extinction, like what was thought to have happened for the dinosaurs, a 200-metre object, which was probably larger than what caused huge devastation in Siberia 100 years ago in Tunguska. The frequency of those colliding with the Earth is probably once every several hundred years. And so we do need to continue with the search for near-Earth asteroids to move the limits down from a kilometre, which I think we've achieved, down to 100 metres, indeed down to 10 metres. To feel safe, and pan-STARRS will of course help quite a lot in that job.
Okay, so we're currently monitoring everything that's a kilometer or bigger, so we can feel somewhat confident that we're not going to have an extinction event without knowing about it first. And as we're monitoring it, it makes me think, how long would we know in advance of such an impact? Would we have a week to run?
I think, like I'm saying, for the kilometers-ish size objects, where the orbits are all fairly well known, we're talking about a very long term. By that I mean several years, if not several tens of years. Enough time in general for lots of mitigating methodologies to come into play, and you can even argue from 6 months or so which one was the best before you sort of employ it. On the other hand, the smaller they are, the harder they are to follow, the harder they are to detect, and the more likely they are to surprise us by going from different directions. And if you only have, well, if all I'm saying is wrong, and a kilometre-sized object is found to be going to hit us in the next sort of 10 hours or something, there really is nothing you can do other than go and have a nice drink and enjoy the last sunset or something.
And listen to the last episode of the Jodcast.
Or whatever, yes. The smaller ones, but basically, they don't cause global catastrophes. They may wipe out a city, which would be pretty bad for that city, and one would, of course, prefer not to do it. But you don't need to deflect it so far so that you hit, say, the sea instead of the city. And so, again, the smaller they are, the easier they are to deflect. So it's good news and bad news on the small ones, but they may be harder to detect and harder to follow because there's more of them as well, and therefore it's much harder to compute all of them. But at the same time, the damage they do is less, and how to deflect them becomes much easier because you don't need such great force to deflect a small thing as you do a large thing.
Okay, we'll close being optimistic then. We're monitoring all the big things, and we're pushing down the limits on what we're keeping an eye on. And the ones that we can track won't cause too much damage, we hope.
We hope.
Okay, with that, I'll say thank you, Professor Williams, for telling us all about comets and asteroids. It's been a pleasure having you on the Jodcast.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.